Malingapa man Mark Sutton is a deep treasure trove of historical and cultural knowledge and an enthralling storyteller. He's been a guide to places of cultural and historical significance in the region for many years. I'm up before the sun to catch a ride with him out to Mutawindji National Park.
G'day, I'm good, how are you?
On the drive, he shares a bit of an introduction to the landscape you'll travel through when you first head north from Broken Hill. From First Nations life to first contact with colonisers and modern day conservation efforts, Mark paints a vivid picture of the history of some of this country.
My name's Mark Sutton. I identify as a Malinyapa man, and the Malinyapa tribe are basically the whole corner country of New South Wales, kind of between Broken Hill and Milparinka. We consider Mutawindji as the southeastern boundary for our tribal lands. All that land was my great-grandmother's country. And I'm employed as the senior tour guide at Mutawindji National Park.
Now we're on our way to Mutawindji now. How many times a week do you drive the road from Broken Hill to Mutawindji?
I generally do this trip 3 times a week on Mondays, Wednesdays and Saturdays. So I meet members of the public out there and take them on a walk through the restricted access area, which we know as the Mutawindji Historic Site, which was first established in 1927. So it contains a lot of remnant vegetation inside that area, which is not found outside of that area because it was protected way back in 1927, making it the first conservation area in far western New South Wales.
And it's got an interesting history in the journey back to traditional ownership as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In 1983, the community was so concerned about the behaviour of some people in that sacred site area that the community held a blockade from the 4th to the 8th of September in 1983. And they effectively said to government, we're not going to let any more tourists into this area until you acknowledge us as the Aboriginal owners and you give us a greater role in the management and care of this landscape.
Do you remember that time?
No, that was before my time. That was 3 years before I even went to Mutawindji for the first time in 1986.
And what's your memory of going to Mutawindji for the first time?
Oh, I have very strong memories. I went with a group of Aboriginal high school students, and we were out there on a cultural camp organised by my aunt. And we were met out there by Uncle William Bates, Mum's brother, and Uncle Badger Bates, Mum's cousin, and they showed us around and they, you know, cooked a kangaroo and really gave us a lovely cultural introduction to that landscape.
And all these years later, you're taking people through that country. What's your journey towards that been? What was the process of you learning those stories and taking that job on?
Yeah, well, when I went there as a 16-year-old, I was just blown away by that country. I was blown away by the rock art, and I was blown away that that was my ancestors' place. I absolutely fell in love with that place on my first visit in 1986 as a 16-year-old, and I vowed there and then that I would come back there one day and work. So from 1986, it took me 7 years to get back there onto that country. After I graduated from uni in Sydney, the first jobs I applied for were with national parks out around Broken Hill and at Mutawindji, and I successfully got both those positions that I applied for, and they said to me, which one do you want? So I accepted the Aboriginal Sites Officer position. I was the inaugural position holder in that job, and I was the Aboriginal Sites Officer for Broken Hill and Tibberborough. So in that role, fresh out of uni, I really got to move right through my traditional lands, and particularly learn about the cultural heritage components, the physical heritage of that landscape, because my role was about protecting burial sites, protecting rock art, you know, artifact scatters, all the kind of physical heritage which is left behind by the movement of our ancestors.
I imagine it's been quite a long process to try and identify even what's out there too, since that return to ownership.
Yeah, well, we're lucky in that a lot of work was done in the early days by archaeologists. There are over 300 recorded art sites at Murrawindji alone. There are other art sites in far western New South Wales, and we're going to pass by some shortly, just on the other side of Yankawinna Creek. As we drive north towards Tipperborough, over on the left-hand side of the Silver City Highway is a place called Palamica. Palamica was an important place in traditional life for ceremony, and particularly centered around Uriyawi Gorge, which I describe as the number two law business place in far western New South Wales. Murrawindji is definitely the number one law business place, but followed a close second by Uriyawi Gorge.
Now, how far out of Broken Hill would you say we are now?
We're about 30 k's, 35 k's now, driving north out of Broken Hill on the Silver City Highway. So we're still in the lands of the Wiliyakali people. W-I-L-Y-A-K-A-L-I, Wiliyakali. The Wiliyakali people consider themselves a group unto themselves, but like a lot of the tribes in far western New South Wales, they also consider themselves a part of the broader Barkindji Nation. The Barkindji tribe were the biggest and certainly most powerful tribe in far western New South Wales. That's probably because they had the Darling River and the Menindee Lakes running through the centre of their tribal lands, which means that they control the major water resources. All of the other tribes who live away from the Darling River needed to have a good ongoing relationship with the Barkindji people, so that in the height of summer, or perhaps during a serious drought, when their water holes dried up, they would have been able to move across to the Darling River and switch to a riverine diet, consuming fish and turtles and yabbies and mussels and the like.
So as people are travelling through this landscape and heading off onto this route up into the corner country and past Murrawindji, it might look to the untrained eye sometimes like a bit of an arid place, but it was really quite a busy place, wasn't it, for a lot of people moving and interacting with each other and trading?
Yeah, absolutely. This landscape is deceiving to the eye, particularly now, because a lot of the trees and vegetation were cut down by the impact of mining in the early days. When they started mining in 1883, they only had steam machinery, and they were using that steam machinery to power things like lights underground in the mines, perhaps fans to suck air in and out of the mines. So to power that steam machinery, they started cutting down the timber and vegetation around Broken Hill, and that extended for a radius of almost 100 kilometres around Broken Hill. All that original timber and vegetation is mostly gone. So this landscape is very much a man-made landscape. Until we get about 100 kilometres away from Broken Hill, only then will we start to get back amongst the original landscape type. But we must also remember that one of the seven different landform types of the semi-arid desert is open grasslands. So there were some areas, and there are some areas, that didn't have trees growing anyway, because that's one of the seven landform types.
And it's the kind of landscape that responds really quickly to water, isn't it? We're seeing that now. Depending on when people are driving through, it can look quite dry, but as soon as a bit of water comes, it really springs back to life.
Absolutely, particularly during a La Nina weather pattern like we're in now. So about every 5 to 10 years, currents out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean will switch. Normally those currents push warm air towards Australia and cool air towards South America. That's why South America is mostly rainforest. But every now and then it will switch and push cool air towards Australia and warm air towards South America. That's the La Nina weather event. So we're in a La Nina weather event now. 2021 and 2022 are La Nina years, and the landscape looks lush and green and beautiful. So that's kind of Kalanaka over there on the left. The range of hills in which Broken Hill is nestled is known as the Barrier Range, and that was named by Captain Charles Sturt on his Australian Inland Expedition of 1844. The Barrier Range is about 50 kilometres wide and about 70 kilometres long, and Broken Hill sits right in the middle of the lower part of the Barrier Ranges. Captain Charles Sturt, the explorer, thought that the Barrier Ranges were an impediment to settlement beyond the ranges. That's why he named it the Barrier Range, and that's why the highway coming through Broken Hill is called the Barrier Highway. As we drive north, further north now along the Silver City Highway, we're about to cross through Yanko Winner Creek, and on the left you can see concrete supports for an old railway line. That railway line used to run out into the hills to the northwest to a little mining community called Tarrawinji, and that railway line was decommissioned and disassembled in the early 1930s. On the right-hand side of the creek now, as we pass through Yanko Winner Creek, there's the old concrete supports for the railway line on the left, and over on the right, just nestled over near those trees, was the site of the old Yanko Glen Hotel. Back in those days of horse transport, there was a pub located about every 25 miles, so that you knew at the end of your day's travel, you could feed and water your horse, and feed and water yourself, and probably get accommodation. To the left now is the Corona Road, which goes out to the South Australian border, and down there along that road is Palamica Station. Palamica Station was purchased by the Indigenous Land Corporation, and it was handed back to the Willyakali people of Broken Hill. And in conversation with Auntie Maureen O'Donnell years ago, I was discussing a government department that I used to work with in Canberra, and I said, why don't you nominate it as an Indigenous protected area? So I believe that she's now done that, and we're just waiting for that landscape to get to the top of the list so that they can then start developing it as a conservation area that is open to the public. But it's being primarily protected for conservation reasons, and particularly to protect the massive collection of rock art which is found there.
And is there any particular or unique animals, wildlife there? I know Mutawindji has a protected kind of species there, don't you?
Yeah, Mutawindji has a few endemic species. The Barrier Range wattle, Acacia becklerii, is an endemic species. The Barrier Range dragon, a little lizard, is endemic to Mutawindji. And of course now, Mutawindji is the only home of the yellow-footed rock wallaby in New South Wales, which we call Wangaroo in language, W-A-N-K-A-R-R-U. The yellow-footed rock wallaby, which is now only found at the Mutawindji Nature Reserve, those animals used to live all through the hills, all the way back to Broken Hill, including in the Barrier Ranges. And there was a photo taken in the late 1800s or early 1900s, I can't quite remember now, and it was a horse-drawn wagon piled high with yellow-footed rock wallaby skins. So they were hunted to extinction in the Barrier Ranges, and as I said at the outset, are now only found at the Mutawindji Nature Reserve, which is about 10 kilometres to the northeast of Mutawindji National Park. There are between 150 and 300 animals in that colony. The population tends to rise to about 300 during La Nina weather events. So when it's wet and green like it is at the moment, there's lots of vegetation, all the water holes are full, that population tends to swell to about 300. During a very severe drought, the population might halve to about 150. So the Mutawindji Nature Reserve exists just to protect that colony of yellow-footed rock wallaby. It's not open to the public, it's only open to park staff, and obviously sometimes Aboriginal owners also go there to inspect infrastructure and just to see how the colony is going.
What is the biggest threat now to those species surviving and thriving?
It's probably the competition that they face with the feral goats. The feral goats are able to access almost any of the landscape which those yellowfoot rock wallabies inhabit. So it's competition by the goats, which is probably our biggest concern. There was thought years ago that the wedge-tailed eagles might be taking those species, but research done by Dr. Andy Sharp, who was out there in the 1990s, found that there was very little predation by wedge-tailed eagles. In drought, they might take a little joey if they're absolutely desperate, but that really, the impact by wedge-tailed eagles was in fact negligible. So probably feral cats are taking some of the small young from occasion, and maybe even pigs on occasion, they might be impacting some of their number.
Now, you mentioned Sturt's journey through this area. Do we know much about his interaction with the Malangapa or the Willikali or any of the mob around here?
Captain Charles Sturt was remembered very warmly by local Aboriginal people. The complete opposite of his antecedent, who was the explorer Major Thomas Mitchell. Major Thomas Mitchell got involved in a couple of nasty incidents when he was in far western New South Wales, so much so that in this part of Aboriginal Australia, we don't call them a Major Mitchell cockatoo, because we don't want to remember or honour Mitchell by naming that beautiful cockatoo species after him. So in this part of Aboriginal Australia, we call it a pink cockatoo. Unlike Captain Charles Sturt, who was a very good expedition leader in that he controlled the behaviour of his expedition members very tightly. So you're making sure that they're always behaving themselves. You're making sure that there's no, you know, unnecessary acts of violence being committed, any acts being committed against any of the women. So Captain Charles Sturt always sought out the advice of local Aboriginal people, because in those early expeditions, they were essentially hopping from waterhole to waterhole. So if you're interacting with the local Aboriginal people and you're doing that in a respectful way, they're probably going to impart knowledge about where the next waterhole is. And often those early expeditions engaged Aboriginal people in so far as they employed them to guide them for certain lengths of those expeditions. Quite often though, they would be surprised when suddenly that guide would just disappear. They would just walk off at a certain point. And that's probably because those Aboriginal people knew that they were now going into country which was not theirs, and that they were perhaps fearful of what might happen if they were seen in that country by the local Aboriginal people. Or maybe they didn't even have knowledge of that country, so they thought, well, this is as far as I can guide them, all finish now and just walk away.
Yeah, boundaries invisible to people from a completely different continent.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, all of our tribal boundaries are of course natural landscape features. They might be creeks, they might be ranges of hills, and that was certainly part of the argument used by Eddie Kawiki Mabo when he challenged the legal lie of terra nullius, because terra nullius, which was used by the English to invade Australia, for want of a better term, because they said that there was no form of agriculture being practiced, no farming, and that there was no delineation of boundaries to mark ownership. So there were no fences as far as they were concerned. There were, of course, it's just that we were using the natural landscapes to delineate ownership of different areas. We can can see on the right hand side some single phase power lines. Now these remote properties were only first connected to the mains electricity grid in 1996, so that's relatively recently. Before that, these remote sheep stations were using diesel generators, so quite often they were using gas fridges. The diesel maybe wasn't turned on during the day, you were only turning it on at night time for light and for cooking and that kind of thing. So the connection of the mains electricity grid to all of these remote properties was very heavily subsidised by the New South Wales and Australian governments. So even Mutawinji was only first connected in 1996. From Central Standard Time, which is Adelaide time, back into Eastern Standard Time, Sydney and Melbourne time. Broken Hill is on Central Standard Time because back in the early days when mining started in Broken Hill from 1883 onwards, they were carting the ore to the South Australian border in horse and cart because the New South Wales government for years refused to build a railway line from Broken Hill to take the ore to South Australia. The South Australian government, however, recognised that they were going to make a lot of money from mining in Broken Hill, so they very quickly established their railway line to the South Australian New South Wales border. Then some enterprising locals formed the Silverton Tramway Company. Back in those early days, it was illegal for a railway company to be privately owned. So if they called it a tramway company, they could bend the rules. So the first railway line to the South Australia border was built by the Silverton Tramway Company. So the train leaving Broken Hill had to meet the train at the South Australian border, and that's why Broken Hill is on South Australian time, so that the trains could meet up at the same time.
I never knew that.
There you go.
Amazing. Of this country, colonisation was done in a really brutal way and in a way that displaced a lot of families. That's a long and complicated history, but can you tell us a bit about how that came about on this piece of country?
The first explorer to come into far western New South Wales was Major Thomas Mitchell. Major Thomas Mitchell was a very ambitious young man. He wasn't born into wealth, but he very quickly made wealthy and influential friends, and he was constantly agitating to try and get a commission in the British Army. He was a very gifted student, particularly good at mathematics, and one of his friends eventually was able to get him a commission in the British Army, and he was posted to the Quartermaster General's Department in the British Army and was stationed during the Napoleonic Wars. Major Thomas Mitchell produced a lot of the battlefield maps for the Napoleonic Wars and served with some distinction, eventually rising to the rank of second lieutenant. After the Napoleonic Wars, he was back in England, and one of his influential friends said, "I think we've found the perfect job for you." And that was the job of Assistant Surveyor General in the colony of New South Wales. His friend said to him, if we can get you appointed as the Assistant Surveyor General, the Surveyor General, John Oxley, is very ill. He'll probably die fairly soon. Once he dies, you will then be appointed as the Surveyor General for the entire colony of New South Wales. Those positions were very distinguished positions. They came with a house and servants and a very generous annual salary. And so Major Thomas Mitchell then arrived in Sydney, and he could have just stayed back in Sydney and been an administrator, but he knew that he was in Australia at a very unique time, and he decided to appoint himself to lead some of the expeditions, because he knew that if he could lead some of the expeditions into the great unknown, that he would make a real name for himself, that he would become a famous explorer. His first expedition went up through the Northern Tablelands, through Armidale, kind of towards Moree. That's, we'll call that Expedition 1. His second expedition and his third expedition are the two that we're particularly interested in today. Expedition 2 went up through what is now known as Bourke. He built Fort Bourke on that expedition and named it Fort Bourke. And they then came down the Darling River towards Wilcannia. One morning, two of the convicts in Mitchell's party sought permission to go down the river to fill up a metal quart pot. Mitchell, being an inexperienced expedition leader, gave them permission to go down to the river without being accompanied by a soldier, which was a no-no. Whenever the convicts are leaving your line of sight, you always send a soldier with them to make sure that they're going to behave themselves. Down at the Darling River, they met a Barkindji man and his wife, and they negotiated a liaison with that woman in exchange for payment of the quart pot. They said to the Aboriginal couple, we can't give you the quart pot now though, because if we go back to camp without it, it might arouse suspicions. We'll meet you back here tomorrow morning. So the next morning, the two convicts went back down to the river. They met the Aboriginal couple, and an argument ensued because they essentially reneged on the deal. They refused to make the payment as agreed the day prior. At which point, at some time during the argument, the Aboriginal man waved his spear in a threatening manner, and the convict used that as a defence to shoot the Aboriginal man dead. That caused the Aboriginal man's wife to start to scream and wail, and the second convict turned and shot her dead. And both those pistol shots woke up their screaming infant child, who was sleeping nearby. And that child was picked up by its ankles and dashed against the trunk of a nearby river, Red Gum. An absolutely terrible atrocity. On Expedition 3, Mitchell came along the Murrumbidgee down the Lachlan to the Murray River, and they were going to travel north along the Darling River through Menindi and Wilcannia. But by this time, the Aboriginal people, the Barkindji people, had heard that Mitchell was back in their homelands. So they very quickly formed a payback party to go and exact revenge on Mitchell and his men for those atrocities previously committed on Expedition Number 2. One morning, someone in Mitchell's expedition yelled out, "Sir, across the river." And they looked across the river and a large party of Aboriginal men started to gather. This was the payback party coming to exact revenge. Every time they looked, it seemed as if the numbers in that payback party started to swell. So Mitchell became worried. He ordered his men into defensive firing positions behind trees next to logs. And when the first Aboriginal man entered the water, presumably to cross the river to attack, Mitchell ordered his men to open fire. And at least seven Aboriginal men were killed in that incident, which Mitchell named Mount Dispersion, because they were able to disperse that presumably or supposedly attacking party. Just recently, the National Parks and Wildlife Service have announced that Mount Dispersion down on the Murray River is now an Aboriginal place protected by the National Parks and Wildlife Act, and that some kind of monument or memorial is going to be erected there in honour of that incident. So it's because of those nasty incidents that in this part of Aboriginal Australia, we don't call it a Major Mitchell cockatoo, that we only call it a pink cockatoo. Mitchell was followed by Captain Charles Sturt on the Australian Inland Expedition of 1844. Charles Sturt was followed by the Crawford Barrier Gold Expedition of 1859. And then there was the infamous Burke and Wills Expedition. Burke and Wills, of course, were the first to ever do a south-north cross-continental expedition of Australia, going from the south to the north and back again. And whilst Burke and Wills were undertaking that expedition, Ernest Giles was doing the first ever east-west cross-continental expedition of Australia. Not long after those expeditions travelled through far western New South Wales, the squatters started to arrive. So they started squatting on land, naming the land, and essentially that's when the big sheep stations started to be established in far western New South Wales. Often within hours of the arrival of those early expeditions, water holes were absolutely ruined. They were pristine water holes with beautiful crystal clear water, but often within hours those water holes were ruined because the stock would be able to smell the water, and they would often run towards the water holes, and they're running into the water holes, they're stirring up all the sediment material on the bottom of the water holes, and as I said, often within hours those water holes were ruined. They became muddy cesspools. So the ruining of natural water holes started to force Aboriginal people further northwest into the corner country of New South Wales, until eventually they were all living on Tibooburra Mission, which was established as a, you know, community residential area. Under the Aborigines Protection Act of the time, Aboriginal people were required to live in designated reserves, or as we know them now, the missions. Aboriginal people living on those Christian missions were not allowed to speak traditional language, they weren't allowed to hunt traditional food, they weren't allowed to perform ceremonies, they weren't allowed to marry without permission, they weren't allowed to get a job without permission, they weren't even allowed to leave the reserve to go into town to go shopping without permission. So by 1938, all the Aboriginal people living on Tibooburra Mission were a real mishmash of all the different Aboriginal tribal groups from far western New South Wales and beyond. And then on one fateful day in 1938, a heap of trucks turned up and Aboriginal people were forced into the back of those trucks. There was no consideration given to the splitting up of family groups. There was no consideration given to the mixing up of different tribal groups. And those trucks then took the Aboriginal people away to the brand new Christian missions, which had been established at places like Brewarrina and Burke and Walgett and Wilcannia and Menindee and Mount Manara. And that's where a lot of those Aboriginal, what are now considered predominantly Aboriginal communities, they were all established because of the Christian missions.
I guess that kind of puts us in the picture of why it's important, and also why it's taken quite a bit of time for a lot of these places and locations to be reconnected to their original traditional owners. What's it like trying to piece that together?
It's been very difficult for us because since day one, these big properties took over our landscapes. In some instances, Aboriginal people were allowed to live on the peripheries of those sheep stations. Some of those sheep station owners and managers were considered a lot friendlier to Aboriginal people, but certainly not all of them. And because these Western Lands leases were established under the Western Lands Lease Act, that has essentially extinguished native title for Aboriginal people in far western New South Wales. The Native Title Act extinguishes any deed of sale or any lease which has ever applied to that landscape. So that essentially extinguishes native title for us in far western New South Wales. All native title really does for us as modern Aboriginal people is it gives us a seat at the table. So let's say that a mining company proposes to mine an area. We are now able to negotiate with that mining company and we can try and get some benefit from that proposed activity, if you could describe it as a benefit, of course. But the other thing that Native Title does is it allows us to establish Indigenous Land Use Agreements, or ILUAs. So that can be with anybody who wants to do anything on that landscape. We can kind of write up an agreement about, you know, how that activity will take place.
Thanks to Mark Sutton for his time and stories. To hear more about those removals Mark mentioned at the end, you can go to my interview with Dr. Lorena Barker, whose family was part of that process. I'm Amy Volkovsky. This episode of Meet the Locals was produced by Bushwitch Productions in collaboration with Jason King Media for the Sturt Steps touring experience. Sturt Steps is a touring route that covers over 1,100 kilometres in the Corner Country, outback New South Wales. This project is funded by the New South Wales Government and administered by the Milparinka Heritage and Tourism Association Incorporated. For more information, head to the website at www.sturtsteps.com.au.